overrate or underrate teams, and its standard deviation is 10.9 points, meaning that about two-thirds of the time the point spread is within 10.9 points of the margin of victory. In a study of professional football games, a similar result was found, with a mean of 0 and a standard deviation of 13.9 points. When Wolfers examined the subset of games that involved heavy favorites, he found something astonishing. There were too few games in which the heavy favorite won by a little more than the point spread, and an inexplicable surplus of games in which the favorite won by just less. This was again Catala's anomaly. Wolfer's conclusion, like Catala's and Poincaré's, was fraud. His analysis went like this. It is hard for even a top player to ensure that his team will beat a point spread. But if the team is a heavy favorite, a player, without endangering his team's chance of victory, can slack off enough to ensure that the team does not beat the spread. And so if unscrupulous bettors want to fix games without asking players to risk losing, the result would be just the distortions Wolfers found. Does Wolfers' work prove that in some percentage of basketball games, players are taking bribes to shave points? No. But as Wolfers says, you shouldn't have what's happening on the court reflect what's happening in Las Vegas. And it is interesting to note that in a recent poll by the National Collegiate Athletic Association, 1.5% of players admitted knowing a teammate who took money for playing poorly. Catala did not pursue the forensic applications of his ideas. He had bigger plans. To employ the normal distribution in order to illuminate the nature of people and society. If you made 1,000 copies of a statue, he wrote, those copies would vary due to errors of measurement and workmanship, and that variation would be governed by the error law. If the variation in people's physical traits follows the same law, he reasoned, it must be because we too are imperfect replicas of a prototype. Catala called that prototype the average man. He felt that a template existed for human behavior too. The manager of a large department store may not know whether the spacey new cashier will pocket that half-ounce bottle of Chanel Allure she was sniffing, but he can count on the prediction that in the retail business, inventory loss runs pretty steadily from year to year at about 1.6%, and that consistently about 45 to 48% of it is due to employee theft. Crime, Catala wrote, is like a budget that is paid with frightening regularity. Catala recognized that the average man would be different for different cultures, and that it could change with changing social conditions. In fact, it is the study of those changes and their causes that was Catala's greatest ambition. Man is born, grows up, and dies according to certain laws, he wrote, and those laws have never been studied. Newton became the father of modern physics by recognizing and formulating a set of universal laws. Modeling himself after Newton, Catala desired to create a new social physics, describing the laws of human behavior. In Catala's analogy, just as an object, if undisturbed, continues in its state of motion, so the mass behavior of people, if social conditions remain unchanged, remains constant. And just as Newton described how physical forces deflect an object from its path, so Catala sought laws of human behavior, describing how social forces transform the characteristics of society. For example, Catala thought that vast inequalities of wealth and great fluctuations in prices were responsible for crime and social unrest, and that a steady level of crime represented a state of equilibrium, which would change with changes in the underlying causes. A vivid example of such a change in social equilibrium occurred in the months after the attacks of September 11, 2001, when travelers, afraid to take airplanes, suddenly switched to cars. Their fear translated into about 1,000 more highway fatalities in that period than in the same period the year before. Hidden Casualties of the September 11th Attack. But to believe that a social physics exists is one thing, and to define one is another. In a true science, Catullo realized, theories could be explored by placing people in a great number of experimental situations and measuring their behavior. Since that was not possible, he concluded that social science is more like astronomy than physics, with insights deduced from passive observation. And so, seeking to uncover the laws of social physics, he studied the temporal and cultural variation in the average man. Catullus's ideas were well received, especially in France and Great Britain. One physiologist even collected urine from a railroad station urinal frequented by people of many nationalities in order to determine the properties of the average European urine. In Britain, Catullus's most enthusiastic disciple was a wealthy chess player and historian named Henry Thomas Buckle, best known for an ambitious multi-volume book called History of Civilization in England. Unfortunately, in 1861, when he was 40, Buckle caught typhus while traveling in Damascus. Offered the services of a local physician, he refused because the man was French. And so, he died. Buckle hadn't finished his treatise, but he did complete the initial two volumes, the first of which presented history from a statistical point of view. It was based on the work of Catullus and was an instant success. Read throughout Europe, it was translated into French, German, and Russian. Darwin read it. Alfred Russel Wallace read it. Dostoevsky read it. Twice. Despite the book's popularity, the verdict of history is that Catullus's mathematics proved more sensible than his social physics. For one thing, not all that happens in society, especially in the financial realm, is governed by the normal distribution. For example, if film revenue were normally distributed, most films would earn near some average amount, and 2/3 of all film revenue would fall within a standard deviation of that number. But in the film business, 20% of the movies bring in 80% of the revenue. Such hit-driven businesses, though thoroughly unpredictable, follow a far different distribution, one for which the concepts of mean and standard deviation have no meaning because there is no typical performance, and mega-hit outliers, which in an ordinary business might occur only once every few centuries, happen every few years. More important than his ignoring other probability distributions, though, is Catullus's failure to make much progress in uncovering the laws and forces he sought. So in the end, his direct impact on the social sciences proved modest. Yet his legacy is both undeniable and far-reaching. It lies not in the social sciences, but in the hard sciences, where his approach to understanding the order in large numbers of random events inspired many scholars and spawned revolutionary work that transformed the manner of thinking in both biology and physics. It was Charles Darwin's first cousin who introduced statistical thinking to biology. A man of leisure, Francis Galton had entered Trinity College, Cambridge, in 1840. He first studied medicine, but then followed Darwin's advice and changed his field to mathematics. He was 22 when his father died, and he inherited a substantial sum. Never needing to work for a living, he became an amateur scientist. His obsession was measurement. He measured the size of people's heads, noses, and limbs, the number of times people fidgeted while listening to lectures, and the degree of attractiveness of girls he passed on the street. London girls scored highest, Aberdeen lowest. He measured the characteristics of people's fingerprints, an endeavor that led to the adoption of fingerprint identification by Scotland Yard in 1901. He even measured the lifespans of sovereigns and clergymen, which, being similar to the lifespans of people in other professions, led him to conclude that prayer brought no benefit. In his 1869 book, Hereditary Genius, Galton wrote that the fraction of the population in any given range of heights must be nearly uniform over time, and that the normal distribution governs height and every other physical feature. Circumference of the head, size of the brain, weight of the gray matter, number of brain fibers, and so on. But Galton didn't stop there. He believed that human character, too, is determined by heredity and, like people's physical features, obeys in some manner the normal distribution. And so, according to Galton, men are not of equal value as social units, equally capable of voting and the rest. Instead, he asserted, about 250 out of every 1 million men inherit exceptional ability in some area, and as a result become eminent in their field. As in his day, women did not generally work, he did not make a similar analysis of them. Galton founded a new field of study based on those ideas, calling it eugenics, from the Greek words eu, meaning good, and genos, meaning birth. Over the years, eugenics has meant many different things to many different people. The term and some of his ideas were adopted by the Nazis, but there is no evidence that Galton would have approved of the Germans' murderous schemes. His hope, rather, was to find a way to improve the condition of humankind through selective breeding. Much of Chapter 9 is devoted to understanding the reasons Galton's simple cause-and-effect interpretations of success is so seductive. But we'll see in Chapter 10 that because of the myriad of foreseeable and chance obstacles that must be overcome to complete a task of any complexity, the connection between ability and accomplishment is far less direct than anything that can possibly be explained by Galton's ideas. In fact, in recent years, psychologists have found that the ability to persist in the face of obstacles is at least as important as a factor in success as talent. That's why experts often speak of the 10-year rule, meaning that it takes at least a decade of hard work, practice, and striving to become highly successful in most endeavors. It might seem daunting to think that effort and chance, as much as innate talent, are what counts. But I find it encouraging because, while our genetic makeup is out of our control, our degree of effort is up to us. And the effects of chance, too, can be controlled to the extent that by committing ourselves to repeated attempts, we can increase our odds of success. Whatever the pros and cons of eugenics, Galton's studies of inheritance led him to discover two mathematical concepts that are central to modern statistics. One came to him in 1875 after he distributed packets of sweet pea pods to 7 friends. Each friend received seeds of uniform size and weight, and returned to Galton the seeds of the successive generations. On measuring them, Galton noticed that the median diameter of the offspring of large seeds was less than that of the parents, whereas the median diameter of the offspring of small seeds was greater than that of the parents. Later, employing data he obtained from a laboratory he had set up in London, he noticed the same effect in the height of human parents and children. He dubbed the phenomenon that in linked measurements, if one measured quantity is far from its mean, the other will be closer to its mean. Regression toward the mean. Galton soon realized that processes that did not exhibit regression toward the mean would eventually go out of control. For example, suppose the sons of tall fathers would on average be as tall as their fathers. Since heights vary, some sons would be taller. Now, imagine the next generation. And suppose the sons of the taller sons, grandsons of the original men, were also on average as tall as their fathers. Some of them, too, would have to be taller than their fathers. In this way, as generation followed generation, the tallest humans would be ever taller. Because of regression toward the mean, that does not happen. The same can be said of innate intelligence, artistic talent, or the ability to hit a golf ball. And so, very tall parents should not expect their children to be as tall. Very brilliant parents should not expect their children to be as brilliant. And the Picassos and Tiger Woodses of this world should not expect their children to match their accomplishments. On the other hand, very short parents can expect taller offspring, and those of us who are not brilliant or can't paint have reasonable hope that our deficiencies will be improved upon in the next generation. At his laboratory, Galton attracted subjects through advertisements, and then subjected them to a series of measurements of height, weight, even the dimensions of certain bones. His goal was to find a method for predicting the measurements of children based on those of their parents. One of Galton's plots showed parents' heights versus the heights of their offspring. If, say, those heights were always equal, the graph would be a neat line rising at 45 degrees. If that relationship held on average, but individual data points varied, then the data would show some scatter above and below that line. Galton's graphs thus exhibited visually not just the general relationship between the heights of parent and offspring, but also the degree to which the relationship holds. That was Galton's other major contribution to statistics, defining a mathematical index describing the consistency of such relationships. He called it the coefficient of correlation. The coefficient of correlation is a number between negative 1 and 1. If it is near plus or minus 1, it indicates that two variables are linearly related. A coefficient of 0 means there is no relation. For example, if data revealed that by eating the latest McDonald's 1,000-calorie meal once a week, people gained 10 pounds a year, and by eating it twice a week, they gained 20 pounds, and so on, the correlation coefficient would be 1. If for some reason everyone were to instead lose those amounts of weight, the correlation coefficient would be negative 1. And if the weight gain or loss were all over the map and didn't depend on meal consumption, the coefficient would be 0. Today, correlation coefficients are among the most widely employed concepts in statistics. They are used to assess such relationships as those between the number of cigarettes smoked and the incidence of cancer, the distance of stars from Earth, and the speed with which they are moving away from our planet, and the scores students achieve on standardized tests, and the income of the students' families. Galton's work was significant not just for its direct importance, but because it inspired much of the statistical work done in the decades that followed, in which the field of statistics grew rapidly and matured. One of the most important of these advances was made by Carl Pearson, a disciple of Galton's. Earlier in this chapter, I mentioned many types of data that are distributed according to the normal distribution. But with a finite set of data, the fit is never perfect. In the early days of statistics, scientists sometimes determined whether data was normally distributed simply by graphing them and observing the shape of the resulting curve. But how do you quantify the accuracy of the fit? Pearson invented a method called the chi-square test, by which you can determine whether a set of data actually conforms to the distribution you believe it conforms to. He demonstrated his test in Monte Carlo in July 1892, performing a kind of rigorous repeat of Jagger's work. In Pearson's test, as in Jagger's, the numbers that came up on a roulette wheel did not follow the distribution they would have followed if the wheel had produced random results. In another test, Pearson examined how many fives and sixes came up in 26,306 tosses of 12 dice. He found that the distribution was not one you'd see in a chance experiment with fair dice, that is, in an experiment in which the probability of a 5 or a 6 on one roll were 1 in 3, or 0.3333. But it was consistent if the probability of a 5 or a 6 were 0.3377, that is, if the dice were skewed. In the case of the roulette wheel, the game may have been rigged, but the dice were probably biased owing to variations in manufacturing, which my friend Moshe emphasized are always present. Today, chi-square tests are widely employed. Suppose, for instance, that instead of testing dice, You wish to test three cereal boxes,